From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis with a show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. The state of California is sending crews made up of more than 100 people to Maui in the aftermath of last week's devastating wildfire. Hundreds of people are still missing on the island. Brian Ferguson with California's Department of Emergency Services says crews will include forensic anthropologists, specialists in urban search and rescue, wildfire debris removal, hazardous waste experts, and 10 canine teams.
You know, we have a lot of personnel. We're blessed with some of the most highly trained folks in the world here in California, and a lot of them.
But some folks in Greater LA haven't been waiting for the state to act. In Torrance, one group of volunteers is hoping to help. Music sets the island vibe outside of Auntie Miley's Hawaiian restaurant. One car after another just pulls up to that place with bags and bags of stuff, all intended for people whose homes and livelihoods burned to the ground in that firestorm that swept through West Maui last week.
We kind of have it separated, the big bags.
Okay.
We have girls' clothes, men's and young boys.
Okay.
Many here, this drive is personal.
My mom is from Lahaina, and her house is gone.
Susan Shimizu says the home where her grandparents once lived, where she and her family have spent a lot of time, burned to the ground. Well, reporter Susan Vallett caught up with Shimizu and others with Hawaiian roots as they stopped by looking for any way to help.
Can I give you women?
Yes.
Shimizu tries to figure out which box to put a top in. When she first saw the news of the wildfire that ripped through the historic former capital of Hawaii, leaving it a desolate moonscape that many fire-weary Californians know well, her first thought was the safety of her uncle, who had been living in the family home.
Luckily, he was on another island, so we're grateful for that. We're grateful our relatives are okay. We do have a friend around the corner from Grandma's house who's missing. So we know there's a lot of people who are going to need help.
The fire destroyed more than 2,000 buildings, a majority of them residential. You may have seen the drone footage of Lahaina after the fire. Shimizu saw it too.
The smokestack by the sugarcane mill is the landmark for us because right past that Lahaina Luna Road on the right side was my grandparents' house, which is my mom's house. Just being able to see that and know exactly where the house was it was surreal. You know, and then it took a couple days to really sink in.
This drive to collect supplies was started by the Longshoremen's Union at the ports of L.A. and Long Beach. A customer told Auntie Miley's Hawaiian restaurant owner Kai Tsukiyama about it. Knowing that many people fled with only the clothes on their backs, Tsukiyama volunteered to turn his restaurant patio into a drop point and got the word out via social media.
They started off with 2 containers, and then it went to 4, and then it went to 7, and they went and sold to 13. We are just giving the community a place to drop it off. The community is the one really doing everything. You know, it's really humbling and overwhelming how much the community is doing.
There's wipes. Here's toiletries.
People have been dropping off everything from non-perishable food and water to tents, coolers, and even sunscreen. There's a stash of female hygiene products since those are supposedly in short supply on the island right now. Tsukiyama says donors have come from all over in the past few days.
The furthest that I know of was Ridgecrest. They drove 3.5 hours to get here, dropped stuff off and went straight back, and then they were supposed to be coming back with another load.
Shimizu is one of those who felt like she needed to do something.
I don't feel like I can do anything else. I'm not rich, so I'm doing what I can. Called all my teacher friends who are retired to come out. So that's who all these people are. My florist, you know, people I worked with here. My dad's over there taping boxes.
Shimizu's dad, Wallace Shiroda of Gardena, has on a hat and tool belt as he assembles boxes to sort supplies. His outlook is one of hope.
We've got to continue. We've got to keep going. The best we can do is help from here.
Shimizu says she's still in shock over it. Even though she grew up in Gardena, for her, that house was the center of Ohana, at the heart of her family.
My dad worked for the airline, and we always were sent home to help, you know, on the farm, help the grandparents. New Year's was a big thing at Grandma's house in Lahaina. We all helped do the big New Year's, Oshigatsu, where everybody got together, cooked a ton of food, and it's just weird to, like, not even think that my kids will be able to see that again.
Oh, you got a whole tub of cheesecake. Oh, I just put some right there.
Lillian Awa is sorting bins of donated toothpaste, toothbrushes, and soap. She's originally from the Hawaiian island of Oahu and now lives in West L.A. She has a soft spot for Lahaina.
I know a lot of people that have, like, honeymoons there, or, you know, one of my good friends, she was proposed to there. And everyone's feeling this, like, deep tie to go, like, how can we help? When you're here in California, I mean, like, you just feel so far away.
That's why Awa wants to be here helping out.
You never know what one little thing you can do, how that's going to help someone directly, because they all need it. There's so many people that need it.
Auntie Miley's Hawaiian restaurant owner, Kai Tsukiyama, has rented storage space for supplies coming in this week so that they don't inundate Maui with too much at once. He's also helping to organize a dinner and music fundraiser in Gardena next month, where 100% of the proceeds will go to an organization helping those displaced by the Lahaina firestorm. But for now, there's a lot of sorting to be done. For KCRW, I'm Susan Ballant.
You want to know how you can help survivors of the fire in Maui? You can find a list of suggestions at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Well, straight ahead, a new book by an LA author takes you from behind bars to the outside. The story of two women and their relationship on the run. That's yours on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and now to another installment from our producer, Juliana Mayo, who chats from time to time with authors and writers of note from all over Southern California. This time, a fictional feminist tale of carceral drama set right here in the West.
I'm speaking today to Ivy Bakota and her Village Green home. It is so green. I love it. She's the author of Wonder Valley, These Women, and most recently, Sing Her Down. Ivy, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so grateful to be here.
In your house.
In my house, yeah.
Well, I'm grateful to be in your house. Let's talk a little bit. Let's just kind of set the stage for listeners as to what Sing Her Down is about.
Sure. It's a novel about two women who are incarcerated in Perryville Prison in Arizona, who receive compassionate release during the initial stages of the COVID outbreak. They are forced into quarantine for 2 weeks in state, which is what happened to prisoners who don't have a home to go to. And they break parole and leave Arizona for Los Angeles. One woman's name is Florence, but she goes by Florida. And she is a affluent white woman who has committed a crime, and she's sort of in denial that she's culpable for it, or sort of doesn't understand the importance of, you know, accepting what she's done. She wants to run away from what she's committed. The other woman is named Dios Mary and goes by Dios, and she is half Latina. And she is not just proud of her crime, but also believes that women are forced to deny or atone for their crimes, and that disempowers them. So she is sort of pursuing Florida to Los Angeles in the hopes that she can convince Florida to accept her true nature as a criminal and become a human being in toto.
I want to talk about Dios and female rage, because that comes up at least in your last two books. In a big way. And she really embraces it. And I feel like it is something society absolutely does not embrace. And I wonder if that's why you have covered it a couple of times now, this like way that women are kind of punished for their rage, even if it isn't a crime.
Absolutely. You know, I think my previous book, These Women, was about violence against women, and Singer Down is about women who are violent. And in promoting These Women, I realized how gendered we treat violence. When a man is violent in fiction, or even in real life, we don't actually need a justification for that. We sort of expect men to have a virile, violent side to them that can either be expressed on a football field or, you know, in the political arena or, you know, in, you know, the crime underworld. And that's totally fine. We don't often ask for the justification of nature versus nurture or, you know, childhood trauma. But when a woman does something out of turn, whether it's speak up against a Supreme Court justice in a confirmation and, you know, say, speak her truth or, you know, kill somebody, we are always looking for the pathology of that. And often the pathology of it is that something bad was done to her by a man. So women are never allowed the power of their own actions in a vacuum. But if a woman is powerful or strong or assertive or aggressive or violent, just because that's her nature, that's like a crime worse than anything that society can attempt to reconcile themselves to. So I really wanted to figure out how to write about women being violent without giving them, you know, a whole backstory that makes it palatable.
Could we maybe, you start the book off talking about rage. Could we maybe read a little bit of that?
Of course. So it's the opening chapter is narrated by a woman named Case, who's incarcerated in prison. She's not one of the main characters. She's murdered somebody and she's quite aware of her crimes and sort of she's not embracing them, but she is aware of what she's done and she's not in denial of it. So let me tell you a story. I know everybody's story. Been collecting them for years. A goddamn library of voices filed away in my head. Sometimes there's not much to tell. But you'll want to hear this one. It's about two women. Two women in a world of women cut off from a world of men until they weren't. You won't believe what women can do. These women, their mistake was in thinking they burned with their own unique rage. Something deeper, darker than what the rest of us feel. Let me tell you, inside we all rage the same. It's how we let it out that differs.
I think another interesting thing that comes up in a few of your books is this idea. It comes up in kind of Remembrances and Sing Her Down, but like this idea of the trouble that adolescent girls get themselves into, because a lot of what happens because things just kind of got off the rails when they were young. And I don't know, I read Reviving Ophelia, you know, in the 90s, and remember reading about how, like, adolescent girls get themselves in the most dangerous situations of, like, any humans in society. And I completely related to that. And we still don't deal with that and the ways that we expect girls to grow up really fast. And then we shove them into these situations and things get out of hand.
I think about that all the time. And I love the phrase going off the rails because, you know, I like in all of my books to try to imagine whether there's a point we can look back on in our lives where things could have been different. And, mm-hmm. you know, I feel quite lucky and virtuous that, you know, I am where I am without horrible things having happened. Because, like, if, you know, if on a night out you decided to drive home and killed somebody, or, you know, if you decided to hang out with these people, not those people, and they took you down a deeper and darker path. And I think, you know, we are on this sort of railroad track of decisions. And all of my books, each character, at least I know, can go back to see where that path diverged and where that they could have gone one way and decided to go another. I mean, that's the whole plot of both Visitation Street and Wonder Valley, is can we find that point? And not necessarily correct it and not mm-hmm. atone for it, but just acknowledge it. But also, you know, I think with women and the adolescent girls, although they make terrible decisions, we are often excusing those decisions. And especially women who are privileged, you know, we say, oh, it's okay, you know, whatever happened. She wasn't in control of what she did. She was drunk or she was high or she had a bad boyfriend. But I think some of those decisions are made, you know, they're bad decisions, but they're made in, you know, full compos mentis. And I think that we don't allow women the power of those decisions. You know, we try to make excuses for them and gloss over it as opposed to sort of acknowledging sort of what happened and trying to figure out why and sort of, you know, acknowledge the power of the decision, even if the decision's bad.
At first, Case talks about wanting to see this mural that has been painted of your two protagonists and asking someone to take a picture of it while they're on the outside. And she's heard that it looks like it's moving. And I wonder if you can talk about that. And then why that is a fixture in a lot of your books.
Well, the reason it's a fixture in a lot of my books is that the same painter is painting all of the murals from Visitation Street, Wonder Valley.
So he's like a fully realized human to you.
Ren, yes.
From the get-go.
Yeah, of course. I mean, he is a major character in Visitation Street, mm-hmm. an even more major character in Wonder Valley. You see a very quick glimpse of him in These Women, mm-hmm. and he's sort of on the periphery here. You don't really see him, but his murals appear. Murals have always, for me, united Los Angeles, especially after Kobe's death, too. You can just sort of see a city coming together using murals. And the murals in this book in particular are a way to sort of animate and point to some of the unrest and social justice issues that background the book. The George Floyd protests, Skid Row murals feature in it. And I wanted this final moment of the book to be captured in a mural because I like the idea that my characters live on forever. Mm-hmm. And they do live on in me, and I sort of know what they're up to now because I think about them. But it was a sort of way to make them eternal in the book's world.
You mentioned Skid Row, and you've definitely worked on Skid Row for a long time. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much of that work informs your work.
It affects my work hugely because, you know, I remember the day that I went to my first creative writing workshop at it was then called LAMP. Now I teach my class independently at the Skid Row History Museum. But mm-hmm. I went to my first workshop and I was nervous, obviously, and I kind of had this one vision of what homelessness was. And my workshop participants were way more educated than I imagined, and they were way more had many more dimensions than just the circumstance of the way they lived. Mm-hmm. And it made me realize that characters in fiction have to be much deeper and more realized than most authors, even the most thoughtful and creative and passionate authors even consider. We should all give our characters as writers even more depth and even more profundity and even more passion and intellect and instinct, you know, criminals especially, and, you know, the disenfranchised people especially. And it's made me really careful to make sure that no one stands in for just a plot point, or no one's like a bad guy, right, or a good guy or a victim. You know, victims are people too, and criminals are people too.
I love another character who, speaking of criminals, who comes in a couple of your books, Essie, the detective downtown, and the way she grapples with her rage and her desire to track these women down. And the more she learns about them, kind of to your point about learning more about unhoused people for the first time, like the more she realizes there's more to them than just this flat idea of criminality.
Yeah, and she sees herself reflected in them too. I mean, mm-hmm. her nature as a cop is to say initially, like, I can't identify with a criminal because what they do is bad and what I do is good. But she sort of stands in my mind for all of the, I hate to use the word suffering, but all of the, you know, patronizing and all of the sexism and all of the small, petty microaggressions that women endure on a daily basis. Like, I think being a woman in the workplace or just in general is an act of violence on a regular, having violence enacted upon you on a regular basis. So, you know, if you can't understand what Dios is mad about, Essie's mad about the exact same thing on a more palatable and manageable level. Like, every one of her actions is on trial. You know, she's a cop, but she's not good enough. Mm. She's the victim of emotional abuse at home. And so she's afraid that that's going to make her look weak in the eyes of her coworkers or her squad or whatever. Essie is, you know, she's every woman. She's the woman who's in trouble for parking the car a little bit over the line or burning the coffee or forgetting to, you know, unplug whatever. And I think that's just the way it is. I don't really think men suffer those minor, you know, criticisms. I mean, I was a professional athlete, and literally guys on the squash, the pro squash tour where I played, they took every opportunity to point out something you did wrong, you know, and I don't think they did that to each other.
I don't know any women who aren't familiar with that.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think I need to go on about it. But I do think
for the men in the back.
But Essie is that example, you know, she is just on trial for her sex or her gender. And she's someone that we can all relate to, unfortunately, but also importantly, because I think we just sort of have made peace with the fact that we as women, that this is the way it is. And we've accommodated ourselves so frequently and made ourselves small so that men can feel big. And, you know, I love the word accommodated ourselves to, you know, the situation and to the sort of constant, you know, commentary about how we fall short of what a man would have done in that situation. And I'd like to say he probably wouldn't have done any better and a lot worse.
Ivy Pakoda, her new book is Sing Her Down. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, and thank you so much.
Straight ahead, a new exhibit at the Venda Museum about Vietnamese modern art and a lecturer who has a lot to say on the subject. You're going to hear from her coming up on the other side of this. Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW. Before you leave us, at the Venda Museum in Culver City, there's an exhibition centering on Vietnamese art from 1976 to today. And while you're there checking out the art, you're going to be able to catch a presentation that happens this Saturday about the golden age of Vietnamese modern art. It's called Reclaiming South Vietnam's Artistic Legacy. Thuy Nd Tran is an independent curator and art historian. She's going to be running the discussion over at the Venda. Thuy, thanks for coming on. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, Steve.
You bet. Tell me a little bit about what you're going to explore in this program. What was the golden age of Vietnamese modernism?
This was a really exciting time. I mean, most of Western scholarship as we know it, you know, and as well as mainstream media about modern Vietnam, mostly have focused on the negative aspects of the Vietnam War. And what I'm trying to offer is, amidst all of this chaos, the political, the ideological chaos, there was this very exciting time happening in Vietnam in the field of the arts. And that includes literature, visual arts, poetry, music. There was this explosion of excitement. And it's really driven by the optimism of decolonization. You know, the French had just withdrawn from Vietnam. There was this new optimism for nation building. And so the cultural life in South Vietnam was this vision of hope and, you know, really like a renewed creativity that is referred to as this golden age of contemporary Vietnamese culture.
It's interesting that you use the title 1976 to today. And I imagine that 1976, you know, it's after the last of the American troops left, right? In that time, this is post-Vietnam War, right?
Right. So the exhibition, which I was not part of the organization of the exhibition, so Vietnam in Transition at the Venda does begin from 1976. And when I first came to see it, I thought it was very interesting. And so my lecture offers what was happening before that period. You know, what there is an art historical gap of 20 years of what was happening in the South. And so I'm hoping that this will give some context to the creation of this progressive modernism.
Are there any favorite pieces that you have that you could describe to us? That's something that if you go, you're like, huh, you need to see this.
When you first step into the exhibition, you'll notice right away the artist Binh Nhân and his chlorophyll prints. And Binh Nhân is well known for these types of imprints on leaves. And what he would do is he would immortalize those leaves into resin. And so metaphorically, you know, it has to do with the deforestation of the jungles in Vietnam and then how that memory seeps into the land, seeps into the cells and fibers of the natural scape. But then that is also a metaphor of the memory of loss, of war. And so the images are of people, they're portraits or scenes of, you know, the Vietnam War soldiers in the rice paddies. And then they become like an altar piece in a way.
That is so it's heavy, beautiful. but it is beautiful too as a memory and as an homage, right? As an homage to what was once there. There is a very large Vietnamese community here in Southern California. I know in Orange County in Westminster, right? There's a very large Vietnamese community. Like, how connected are people here of Vietnamese descent or from Vietnam connected to current day Vietnam or even those days that your lecture will be talking about?
A lot of the people who are here in Southern California, as well as Northern California, we do make up the largest Vietnamese population outside of Vietnam. Since the opening of Vietnam, you know, in the mid-1990s when the embargo was lifted, there has been much more confluence between the two, you know, across the Pacific. There are a lot of expatriates that have returned to Vietnam to live and build a life, and then vice versa. You know, the history of this era that I'm lecturing about is mostly in the minds and the memories of the diaspora. So it's this collective memory that I'm trying to kind of piece together. And so I am still in the midst of, you know, researching and collecting these kinds of pieces to build it back together and to give the time period, you know, the due spotlight that it deserves.
Well, it's certainly, it sounds fascinating, and I want to thank you for coming on. I know this is part of a larger exhibition of contemporary Vietnamese art over at the Venda that runs through late October, but Thuy N. D. Tran's presentation, Reclaiming South Vietnam's Artistic Legacy, is happening this Saturday at 2 o'clock over at the Venda. Thuy, thank you so much for coming on and joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow on the program, you ever been through those canyon roads like Beverly Glen, Coldwater, Laurel Canyon? And you see those homes perched right there on the hillside or on the mountaintop, hundreds, maybe even thousands of feet up? Well, by and large, they're safe, but they do dangle over canyons on stilts. Stilts are holding everything up, and they can be a little unnerving. We're going to take you on a tour of some stilt homes tomorrow on Greater LA. Visit us anytime online at kcrw.com/GLA or on the iPhone or Android app too. And you can grab the podcast while you're there. You can get the podcast wherever you get your podcast just by searching KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordall all helped with this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time and thanks for that ear. Have a great night.